This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. With Tuesday night's primary elections, a victory for Florida progressives as Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum surged to victory, clinching the Democratic Party's nomination for governor. And the night spelled the end of Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam's gubernatorial aspirations at the hands of his rival in the GOP primary, Congressman Ron DeSantis. Does the primary signal a shift in both these parties? How will DeSantis and Gillum go about winning the votes of independents in Florida? Is it a moment of fracture for the Democrats and the GOP, or a change in direction? Are you headed to the Democratic rally in Orlando this afternoon? What are you hoping to hear in the months leading up to the general election? We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can join the conversation. Send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. Joining me in the studio, Molly Nardella, Republican political analyst and attorney at Nardella & Nardella. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And Democratic political analyst Jason Henry. Jason, welcome to Intersection.
Well, thank you for having me as well.
And you can join the conversation too. That number, 1-866-338-5252. Are you buoyed by the primary or a little bit deflated? Are you switching parties? Call us at 1-866-338-5252. We're over on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Send us your comments and questions. Jason, how did the pollsters get this so wrong on the Democratic side?
You know, I think, you know, we're talking off air that there were so many candidates in this race. It was five of them. 2 days before the election, one poll showed that Andrew was in second and another showed that he was in fourth. So on the left side, nobody got it right. But for the Republicans, it seemed that all the polls 2 months out were all correct. So I don't know. I guess we'll flip a coin next time.
Mm-hmm. Let's just hear a little bit of sound from Andrew Gillum. This is a day after the election win. Here he is.
We had over 500,000 people come out yesterday and support the underdog candidate at a very, very grassroots level. I think my four opponents combined may have spent close to $90 million to our six.
So talking about the money, the grassroots candidates, are there sort of shades, echoes of previous candidates you can think of here, Jason? What are we witnessing here?
I think it's almost a continuation of what Bernie Sanders had in 2016, where there was so much energy that it was tangible surrounding his campaign. And I think we saw that with Andrew. 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, Bernie came down and held a rally, and it's like Andrew's campaign just took off. So, you know, I think that this election is going to be framed as Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump, where both candidates represent the edges, if you will, of the party. And Andrew just did a really good job of taking advantage of what Sanders was able to bring.
Mm-hmm. Well, back to the polls. As Jason was saying, Molly, the things on the Republican side a little bit easier to predict. How bad did it look for Adam Putnam going into the night?
It didn't look good. I think we knew about a month out that Ron DeSantis was really going to run away with this. And you knew the same. You had Rick Scott on the top of the ticket, no race there. And then you saw Mike Miller really come out swinging and go up 20 points against Scott Sturgill. So we really didn't have a lot of close races on our side.
Mm-hmm. Ron DeSantis has been seen a lot on Fox News in the lead up to the primary. Have you been watching a lot of what he's saying, and what have you learned about him?
I've learned a lot about it from my own research. I actually don't watch Fox News. I've seen some clips here and there. Mm-hmm. But I've been really impressed by just the Google researches I've done of them. And I would encourage everyone to do that of both candidates. But this was a guy I learned I had no idea. Went to Yale, graduated magna cum laude while playing baseball, while working apparently. Graduated top of his class from Harvard Law School. Could have had any job in the world. And then went to the Navy. So that's what I've learned through my research. I don't know as much about Fox News, but I do know they have a large viewer audience.
Mm-hmm. So he was able to speak to that base, and that might have had something to do with propelling him over the finish line there.
Absolutely. Anytime you get free media, that's a good thing for your campaign.
Mm-hmm. So we've got a couple of baseball players or former baseball players making some headlines in the primary there, because Mike Miller was a pitcher too, right?
Yeah, he was. I have no idea what Ron DeSantis played. I should have dove a little deeper on Wikipedia.
Let me just play a little more from some of the election night parties that were happening around the state. Here is a supporter celebrating Andrew Gillum's win in South Florida on Tuesday night. This is Elizabeth Judd talking to WLRN.
Power of the black vote is underestimated by the black community, but not other communities. And we need to accept the fact that we got it. We are the it when it comes to elections.
So, I'm wondering about that, Jason Henry. What do you think of that voter, that supporters' kind of analysis there? Is this kind of an untapped source of potential that maybe voters don't even realize they have themselves?
I wouldn't necessarily say so. I think with Andrew, there were some echoes of Obama where once a lot of voters, black voters included, realized that he was viable, then you had a lot more support to kind of come his way. And there was a really good article, I think, in the Naples News that showed that four counties, and I think it was Broward, Orange, and a couple more, where the black vote really pushed Andrew over the top. And I think that's important because Orange is a blue county. We know that Republicans aren't going to win here. But if you're able to stretch those margins and black voters are overwhelmingly going to come out for one candidate, then that can matter if Andrew's either behind in some of the smaller counties or loses some of the smaller counties. If he's able to stretch those votes out in some of the, you know, strong Democratic counties in the state, then that matters a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that, too. I think Orange was one of the other counties as well.
Mm-hmm. It was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me just hear a little bit from on the other side of the aisle there. Here's some Ron DeSantis sound. This is Gary Snow. He was at the DeSantis election night party in Orlando Tuesday. Snow talked to 90.7's Brendan Byrne. Let's take a listen.
Well, Adam Putnam, I think he was born and bred to be a politician. Ron DeSantis has seen and done different things. And I mean, I think that's why, you know, Trump supporters liked him, because he's something fresh, he's something right. new. He's not the same old establishment, you know, Republican.
What do you make of that? Is that, I mean, is this kind of an extension of the Tea Party wave, out with the old and with the new?
Molly Somewhat, Nadella? Matt, but I've been hearing that for years. People really like people coming from different backgrounds with different experiences, especially experience in the private sector, mm-hmm. and then going into public life. And Ron DeSantis had that. You know, he served in the Navy. He mm-hmm. came back. I think he was a federal prosecutor in the Middle District.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ran for Congress. I think he's only been there two terms.
Yeah, he's
And now he's running for governor, as opposed to some people on the ticket who have been in public life
mm-hmm.
their entire adult life. And, mm-hmm. yeah, I think that's popular with the voters.
Well, we're going to get some calls in here. The number's 1-866-338-5252. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead. Are you there? We seem to have lost that call there. Let's go to another one here. Okay. Are you there? We seem to be losing that one too. Little issues with our phones. We can take your comments on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando this morning. What are your thoughts about the election on Tuesday night, and what are your thoughts about the policies you're hearing from both these candidates? So Ricky writes in on Twitter, the American public supports Gillum's policies. He is not running from the left. He is running from the bottom up. That's an interesting thought there. Kind of get back to that grassroots idea. What do you make of that, Jason Henry?
You know, what's funny about Andrew Gillum and even some of the candidates that are considered to be far left now is that 30 years ago, maybe even 40 years ago, these were just regular base Democratic positions. And now that I think the party has kind of shifted so far to the center and maybe even to the right a little bit,
mm-hmm.
that candidates like Andrew seem like they're far left. But this, honestly, some of the things that he's talking about, like universal health care and making sure that we have enough money for education, these aren't socialist policies. They aren't far left policies. They're just policies that are germane to the Democratic Party. So it's just interesting to watch how far removed we've gotten from where the Democratic Party used to be.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about some of these things, I mean, what are we saying? Like minimum wage?
Minimum wage increased to $15. He's talking about legalizing recreational marijuana. He's talking about putting $1 billion back into education. Those things, to me at least, because I'm a Democrat, those aren't controversial.
Mm-hmm.
But Ron DeSantis, he's come out the gate swinging, saying that, Andrew's socialist policies aren't going to be good for the state of Florida. And there's not really much socialist about what he's talking about.
Well, in all fairness, there was a Democratic mm-hmm. debate where Andrew Gillum was asked, and I was just shocked it was a question.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a capitalist? Or are you a socialist? And he punted.
He did punt.
That is unbelievable.
He did.
I do think he's far left. I think he's far left for the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
This is a gentleman who wants to abolish ICE, who believes that we should have Medicare for all,
mm-hmm.
that we should expand Medicaid in the state of Florida by 1 million people. And I just don't see where that money's coming from. He says he's going to create a corporate tax. I think that's bad for our economy. We have a very strong economy, thanks, I think, to the president's policies and to Rick Scott, who's been laser focused on growing jobs and diversifying our economy. So I would disagree. I think Gwen Graham represented the center.
Mm-hmm. Was Gwen Graham somebody that a Republican like you could have voted for?
I could not have. But I think she was more a blue dog Democrat like her father. Mm-hmm. I think Andrew Gillum is obviously more like Bernie Sanders. I think that's going to have trouble in the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think for both candidates, again, it seems as if they're representing the edges, because on our side, we feel that Ron DeSantis is far right, that some of the policies that he, you know, wants to espouse. And he said, you know, he wants to support the president's agenda and Rick Scott's agenda. And I think that Rick Scott has been terrible for the state of Florida. So if we're looking at some of the jobs that, you know, Scott has said that he's created, and, you know, he keeps lowering the corporate income tax his first year in office, he cut all this money from education, and we still haven't returned to those, you know, pre-recession levels. I think that continuing those types of policies would be bad for the state. But again, if we're talking about some of the things that Andrew stands for, I just don't think that that far left. And to your point about Gwen Graham, I think that that would have been an easier battle for the Republicans, because Gwen is in the center. I think with Andrew, you have a better chance because there's so much energy surrounding his campaign. With Gwen, I think you would have had a tough time even get people to volunteer for her.
Well, I want to before we go to you, Molly, I'll give you the right to reply there. But let me just go to some more from our DeSantis supporter, Gary Snow, who was talking to WMFE at the DeSantis party. When he was asked about the idea of DeSantis moving away from his Trump endorsement to a more political center, and he said, really, DeSantis should stick to what he's been doing up until now.
The political environment that we are, and I'm speaking as a former Democrat. Mm-hmm. You know, I left the Democratic Party because there is no such thing as a classic liberal. There's no such thing as a Kennedy liberal. What happened to the Democratic Party is they moved into a progressive, radical, liberal movement. They are complete obstructionists. It doesn't matter what Ron DeSantis says. It doesn't matter what President Trump achieves in office. They are going to oppose and obstruct everything that they do. Andrew Gillum, Gwen Graham, Philip Levine, they've all campaigned on one thing. They're going to oppose Donald Trump.
I wonder what you make of that, Molly. I mean, does that sort of tally to what you've seen of Andrew Gillum? Is he running against something, i.e. against Trump? Or does it seem to you, looking at it from the red side of the aisle, that he is kind of campaigning for things?
You know, I think they're both doing both. I think Andrew Gillum is running for an agenda which is very different from the president's and is more progressive and socialist than we've ever seen in the past. So I think he's standing for things like abolishing ICE, like creating a corporate tax in the state of Florida. We've never had one. Mm-hmm. He wants to tax corporations. You know, I think those are things he's actually running for. I know he disagrees with this president, but I do think he set out his own agenda. I just don't think it's an agenda that the people of the state of Florida want to embrace.
You would have the opposing view there, Jason. You're looking a little bit puzzled by that.
No. I disagree, obviously. I think that what Andrew is facing, obviously, is a really, really tough battle. Donald Trump won the state, even though Obama won it twice. I've always said that this state is red, even when Obama did win it. But because, again, we have a candidate as opposed to Charlie Crist in 2014, as opposed to Alex Sink before him, that is running for something, that the candidates that we have on the Democratic side have always kind of tried to hedge their bets and try to play to the middle, whereas Andrew's like, no, I'm not going to run as Republican light. I'm going to run as the candidate that stands for these things. So it's win or lose. It's not, hey, we're going to try to move a little bit to the center to try to embrace everything, which to that point, I think Andrew's going to have to move a little bit further to the center, but not so far that you don't know who he is. And I think that's the type of candidate that we've been waiting for.
Mm-hmm. What about Ron DeSantis on that note? I mean, does he kind of represent a move of the Republican Party more to the right?
I don't think so on a policy standpoint. I think him and Ron DeSantis and Adam Putnam on a policy standpoint were very similar. And I think Ron DeSantis in Congress did some very middle-of-the-ground things that most people can get behind. Mm-hmm. I was looking up because I didn't know much about him. He supported a bill called, if you don't pass a budget, you don't get a paycheck. Uh-huh. I think everyday people are like, I like that. Your job, if you're in the House of Representatives, is the purse strings of this government. Right. If you don't pass a budget, you shouldn't get a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's some middle ground things that people will like about him.
But you were saying before that you can kind of hear echoes of what that fan of Ron DeSantis was saying at the election night, buddy. Granted, the audio is a little bit loud. It was a little hard to hear what he was saying. But essentially, he was saying that that the kind of blue dog Democrats you were talking about earlier kind of don't exist anymore.
It seems that way. It seems in my lifetime there has been a loss of the more centrist Democrats, especially in the last, I don't know, 4-8 years?
It's in the last 8 years, yeah. I'd agree with that. I think that there's not really much room, so to speak, from the outside looking in for blue dog Democrats. But I'm the type I don't consider myself a liberal, but I'm the type of Democrat that believes that we've shifted too far to the center or even too far to the right to where candidates, again, like Andrew Gillum, and even though Bernie Sanders isn't a Democrat, and I can't remember the young lady's name in New York, and Stacey Abrams in Georgia, and Ben Jealous and mm-hmm. in Maryland, these candidates, again, are just talking about issues that I think that regular folks can get behind, like Medicare for All or raising the minimum wage to $15, because these are things that are directly affecting them.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take a call now. We are having a few issues with our phones, but I believe we have Robert on the line. Are you there, Robert?
Yes, I am.
All right. What are you thinking about kind of reflecting back on Tuesday and listening to the conversation now?
I think that the comment that politicians should be more like business people is the whole premise is wrong. Businesses are really there to maximize profit. One of the biggest costs for any business is labor costs. So businesses' interest is to maximize profit. They're not in the interest of the community. I think politicians should be a counterbalance. They should defend the interests of the people. They should not be more like business, because business people mentality and headset is completely different than what you would think a politician's interest would be, which is to protect the community. Mm-hmm. So I think the whole premise that politicians should be more like business people is fundamentally wrong and flawed.
Does it just depend, though, on how big the business is? I mean, if you talk about a small business person versus somebody who's run a multinational corporation, is there kind of a difference of perspective there?
Well, I even think that even on the commissioner, local commissioner level, I would think that's the lowest level of politics. I still believe that there are issues in the community that where the interests of a business maximizing profits would go counter to the interest of the community.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of looking for somebody who can be a bit of a break on some of the commercial interests that are maybe challenging some aspects of the state. Thank you for your call, Robert. I do appreciate you weighing in. What are you hearing there, Jason? I mean, does that seem like somebody kind of who could vote for an Andrew Gillum or a candidate who has those kind of policies?
Sounds like it to me. I think that we've heard that a lot, that government needs to be run more like business, that we need more business people in government. And from our perspective, we don't necessarily need that. We've had a candidate or a governor for the last 8 years that came from business and has completely ruined the state, in my opinion. And you have other candidates of that nature. Donald Trump is supposedly a businessman and he's ruining the country. So I don't think that we need any more individuals from a corporate standpoint, at least, that are going to come in and try to represent their business interests over the interests of the people.
And I guess that kind of depends. If you think Donald Trump's ruining the country, it depends on where you stand, right?
Absolutely.
Because there are millions of people in this country who
think
he's doing a great job.
There are probably millions of people in the state that think that Donald Trump is doing a good job.
Mm-hmm. Molly Nardella, I'm wondering what you heard in that call. I mean, does it seem like there does need to be a little more of check and balance on some of the business interests that are working in the state of Florida?
I think Robert and I come from a little bit of a different perspective. I'm a small business owner, work every day to create jobs for regular people so that we can grow the economy. And I think that Rick Scott has done a phenomenal job. We have a unemployment rate that's below 4%. We've hit a growth rate that's above 4%. People said that was impossible. Mm-hmm. And when you have a strong economy, that helps everyone, regardless of your race or your creed or your gender. That helps everybody.
But here's the thing that I wonder, and I did hear this from one candidate. I don't remember who it was, but it's one thing to say you're growing jobs, but if you have to work 2-3 jobs just to keep your head above water, there's something wrong with that picture, right?
There's always more you can do, and I think the governor has really focused, Governor Scott, on diversifying our economy base, so it's not just service, because service jobs tend to be more low income.
Mm-hmm.
There's always more you can do, but man, we shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth. We should realize what a good and prosperous time we live in, and realize that it didn't happen by accident. It happened because of conservative policies, I believe, that were put in place by our leaders. And so I think we should be grateful for where we are.
Going to take another call here. This call, I believe, some thoughts about outsider candidates. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I just, with the argument and the discussion about outsider candidates, with the governor's race right now, we have one candidate who comes from the Harvard-Yale pedigree, and we have another candidate who has a background in our state with getting public education. And, you know, we talk a lot about candidates that come from something less and work their way up. And I just think there's a value that we're missing here in this whole discussion when we refer to the Republican populist candidate as someone who's an outsider when really he's been on the inside track for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. Interesting thought. Thanks for your call, Matt. I appreciate that. I mean, does that sort of go back to the grassroots notion there, Jason? I wonder what you think there.
Well, I think it's interesting that the two candidates on both sides, Andrew Gillum has been an elected official for a while. He was the youngest person on the Tallahassee City Council, then matriculated and won the mayoral race, and now he's running for governor. And on the other side, you had Adam Putnam, who had been elected since 1996, ran for Congress and won, was agriculture commissioner, and he was running for governor. So these are two positions that those guys were kind of running for their entire lives. And Ron DeSantis, you know, like Molly says, has just been a two-term congressman. And now that he's in this position to run for governor, I think he's positioning himself as an outsider. But both of these guys are kind of on the inside. They've been in politics pretty much, I want to say Ron's entire life, but Andrew's been in politics his entire life. But because, again, of the policies that he's standing for, it makes it seem as if he's an outsider. I think he's just representing the interests of the people.
What are your thoughts, Molly?
Man, I didn't think that was a fair comment at all about Ron DeSantis that our caller brought in. And I'll tell you why. He comes from a blue-collar family, too. He doesn't have Bush on the end of his name. That's not why he got into Yale. He got into Yale because he worked really hard in high school. And he got into Harvard because he worked really hard at Yale. And he did great. And I think that's something that we should be impressed by and support and I think embrace. I think it's great when a hometown boy from Jacksonville makes it all the way to the Ivy Leagues, does well, and then comes home. Mm-hmm. Doesn't go to New York to make a big paycheck. So,
I want to get a couple more comments in on Twitter. Charlie writes, we are forgetting that Bernie Sanders should have won the Democratic nomination. The American voters want real change. Scott has been the worst thing for the Florida in the history of the state. As a native Floridian, praying Gillum wins. There is more to success than money. Well, somebody kind of shares your views there, Jason. and kind of getting back to that idea of just riding in on the Bernie Sanders wave, I find it interesting that maybe some of these folks who were supporting Bernie Sanders in the election and or the primaries at least way back before 2016 now have found a candidate they can coalesce around.
Well, I think it certainly helps that Andrew's a Democrat. One of Bernie's main issues is that he's an independent and he did not want to switch over to become a Democrat. And I think that turned a lot of people in the party off from what he was attempting to do, even though they believed in some of his positions. And with Andrew, you don't have that. Again, he was a Hillary delegate back in 2016. He supported her. And now, you know, that he's running for governor, I think some of the people who may have been behind Hillary in 2016 can say, yeah, this is a candidate that we can get behind because he is a true blue Democrat and he's standing for some of the everyday policies that Floridians can get behind, like raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Real quick, in the final minute we have here, Molly, what does Ron DeSantis have to do to win over those voters in the middle?
I think he's got to govern. He's got to say he's going to govern like he was a congressman. Those common sense things like we talked about, balancing the budget. He had another great law, which was if a regulatory agency doesn't enforce an act of Congress, they have to give a written reason why. I love that. I think the people of the state of Florida are going to love that.
What are your thoughts, Jason, on Andrew Gillum? What does he have to do to win over some of those blue dog Democrats or folks who are maybe more moderately inclined?
Continue to talk about what he wants to do for regular Floridians. He's done a really good job of doing that so far. Just talking about budgetary issues, health care. I think that's going to be really important for him to win over even some of those on the right side because it hits you right in the purse string.
Jason Henry, Democratic political analyst, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
And Molly Nardella, attorney with Nardella & Nardella, and Republican political analyst, thank you so much as well.
Happy to be here.
Still to come, the shooting last weekend, an esports tournament in Jacksonville shocked the gaming community. We'll hear from an esports competition organizer about questions being asked about safety and security in the aftermath of that tournament. Intersection is back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The fatal shooting at a Madden 19 esports competition in Jacksonville last weekend sent shockwaves through the gaming community. Alex Jabaley says he's been a gamer ever since he was 4 years old. The organization he created to put on fighting game competition, CEO Games, has grown to where his events draw thousands of competitors and spectators from all over the world. He says the shooting last weekend has gamers asking about security at tournaments. Well, Alex Jabaley is the founder and director of CEO Gaming. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Not a problem at all. How are you today?
Pretty good, thanks. So what kind of went through your mind when you heard about that shooting in Jacksonville?
So I was in Nashville helping out with another event. And as soon as I had heard the news, I remember I was walking by and seeing it on the news, Jacksonville shooting. And right away, I was starting to get messages from family members because they assume anything gaming related in Florida, I'm a part of, which is funny and cool at the same time. But I was just devastated when I had found out where it was, because I actually, the owners of that bar have partnered with my event before, and they've come and I've helped promote them. And I know community members that run events there that aren't the Madden side, but the fighting game side. So I was just like, oh my God, this is not happening. And, you know, obviously wait for more details to come out. And then just to find out that it was one of the gamers in attendance that had caused the problem. Like, you know, I'm a forward thinker. Once I heard them, like, here we go. You know, after years of wondering if this could ever happen to our community, and it, you know, it did. So it was a big shocker. I was happy to hear anybody I personally knew what, you know, wasn't involved, but just to hear what happened and, you know, players coming together to game. And even though Madden is not a game I you know, host events for or anything, we're all part of the same community. So it was just one of those things that shocked all of us in gaming. And in the past, you know, I had CO 2016 a few weeks after the Pulse shootings. And I had to, you know, reassure people that I'm going to bump up the security. And luckily, not a single incident had happened. Everyone had felt safe. So I felt good, you know, as an organizer, being able to step that up and take care of people. The hard thing is, though, security costs money. We can all do our best to protect everyone inside our little venue. But again, just one of those complete shockers to hear all about it.
Alex Jabaley, how close-knit is the esports community? Because there were folks from all over the country at this event in Jacksonville, and I'm sure you get the same thing at the event that you run.
They're very close-knit, obviously, through the advent of social media and Twitter and Facebook groups, being able to connect. You know, at any moment, you can talk to everybody. You can talk about the games you play, YouTube videos and all that. Of course, not a lot of fighting game players will be related to the, you know, the Madden side of things or the sports esports side of games, but it's one of those where everyone from any game you played was coming together through social media. You know, donation drives have begun for the Good Luck Have Fun bar to help the victims, just to see a lot of us come together. And this is one of those points where, as an organizer myself, I love seeing people come together, because that's what I do in life, is bringing people together. But it's at a point where we have a voice now, where esports is growing so big and some of our celebrities are in the millions of followers range, that we need to start using our voice to protect everyone else, see what can be done about, you know, a very touchy subject. Is a lot of gamers, we just want to play video games. We don't think about the politics side and what really goes on behind the scenes. But now a lot of us are starting to think, like, is there anything I can do on the, you know, the politics side, or vote for someone that's, you know, for gun reform or protecting people the best they can, and, you know, coming to the root of the problem with possible mental health disorders, and giving people that counseling they need that the moment they feel they're lonely or whatnot. So it's a very deep subject to get into, but everyone's so close together. I think now everyone's going to pay attention to every kind of game. Doesn't matter what game you play, which is good and bad, because now we're always going to be worrying and such. But it's one of those situations where we just got to come out on top and see how we can do to prevent it from happening again.
And talking about politics and some of those issues you mentioned, I mean, gun safety, for example, you went on Twitter right after this shooting in Jacksonville and started, you know, voicing some of your thoughts on the issue. Is it something that either gamers or event organizers have been a little bit wary of getting involved in the past? And are you seeing people like yourself kind of willing to speak up now?
Of course, you know, there's those situations where people are always afraid to speak up and get any attention to them, especially on the legal side, you know, with lawyers, you know, coming in and starting to crack down on every venue needing security. But it's one of those situations where this could happen anywhere, and it does happen everywhere. And it's becoming a part of the American culture, which a lot of us are getting sick of. And, you know, it's out of a lot of our control, and we're trying to learn how we can help fix that. So it's going to be an even bigger concern ever. I know a lot of other event organizers in my space are already looking into, you know, possible metal detectors, more bag checks. And I did a bag check with CO Daytona, and they caught one person with a concealed carry license trying to bring a gun just unknowingly. He wasn't trying to cause harm or anything, but once they caught it, which made a lot of us feel at first a little uneasy because they weren't sure of the details, but once we found out, you know, hey, you can't bring this in, he goes, no problem, takes it back to his car, cooperates, come back in, and enjoys the event. So it's one of those situations, just having that open dialogue of what can be done, and I think it's going to happen a lot more now, but at what point do we, you know, stop or feel safe again where we don't need to do this? So is this something that's going to carry on forever as esports gets bigger and every single event security is going to be like the number one concern? And I see a lot of the new guys trying to do events when they realize the costs of, you know, protecting everybody more than they can do by, you know, hands-on by themselves. It's going to scare a lot of people away from trying to do what they do if they enjoy doing it.
You've got an event coming up in September, right? Are you getting questions from people who are attending, concerns, and what are you doing to reassure folks?
The cool thing about my event is we get people from all over the world. My big one in June every year, we have over 30 countries represented in almost every United States state. This year, we're already over 30 U.S. states, and I would say about 10 to 12 countries. And this is CEO Taku. It's on average about 500 to 1,000 players come out and attend. And of course, a few are a little weary of coming, especially from out of overseas. Everybody that lives overseas, you know, whether it's the UK or come from Australia, come from countries that they don't have to worry about this stuff. They're too afraid to come. And I've seen some Japanese players worried. But the good thing is people took notice of when I did do the beefed up security in 2016. And a lot of the other players, like, you know, Alex and his team have always cared about security and making sure everybody feels safe. So I feel confident and comfortable going to this event. So that's kind of put a lot of ease on people's minds. It's not a, you know, you make a phone call, go, okay, I need metal detectors. It's one of those conversations you need to have. But at this point, yes, I'm going to do the best I can to beef up the security just like I did with Daytona. And then the best thing I tell everybody, you know, to friends and staff, like if you see something, just do something about it. You have to say something, you know, before it gets out of hand, and then just be wary of your surroundings. You know, I can't control what happens. I can't control every single individual that comes into my event. Best thing I can do is the immediate area that I'm in charge of is make sure to always keep an open eye and have everyone feel protected the best they can.
You mentioned the attendance as far as the competitors. What about spectators? Because this is a spectator sport, right? How many people are you expecting to turn out to CEO Taku?
CEO Taku, you know, generally last year, the event, it's its fourth year. It was basically themed around the anime fighters, which aren't usually the biggest turnouts in terms of tournaments. But last year we had about 300-400 spectators, usually family and friends of the players themselves. So I'm expecting about the same, you know, 400 to 500. The venue itself, it fits quite a lot of people. It can fit about, you know, 5,000 across all the ballrooms. But, you know, we have two symbol ballrooms that'll be very easy to monitor and guard that we're using for this event. So I expect around, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 total people between the players and spectators. But we'll actually have some hands-on stuff with the artist alley, vendors, you know. So we have a lot of vendors as well and a lot of people that are experienced at many conventions, not just mine, that can also help keep an eye out on everything.
Well, Alex Jubaley is the founder and director of CEO Gaming. Alex, thank you so much for your time.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Still to come, Chris Belt is a classical guitarist, but he didn't set out to be a musician.
I wanted to be a spy. I wanted to go into, like, intelligence, basically, and I thought that that was my path. I'm going to work in languages and intelligence.
Music from Chris Belt, that's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to revisit an interview we first aired on Intersection in August 2017. With us in the studio, guitarist Chris Belt with a piece called Canción para Beatriz by the composer Simone Iannarelli.
Thank you.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With us in the studio, Chris Belt, with a song called Canción para Beatriz. Thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Chris, tell me about the piece you just performed.
The piece is special for me because it was the I recorded it in 2012 for the bridal processional at my own wedding.
Wow.
So my wife, Beatriz, walked down the aisle to me playing a song called Canción para Beatriz. So it's very special to me. And I just wanted to play something really pretty. A lot of what I do in contemporary classical music is not especially, just light and pretty. So I thought today it would be nice to do that. Plus the show, you know, in the morning, something nice for people to hear.
So your wife, Beatriz, she's a musician as well?
Yeah, she's an oboist, and she performs with orchestra. She just went on tour in Japan with a pops orchestra in January, and she also plays a lot of pops music around town. She plays with the Philharmonic sometimes, and we play together in a duo called Belt and Ramirez.
Mm-hmm. Now, what style of music is that? Do you incorporate some of the more contemporary classical sounds, or is it more like what you are playing today?
We do a little bit of both. So we actually do another piece by Simone Iannarelli, a piece called Omaggio a Fellini, dedicated to the filmmaker Federico Fellini. So we play that piece. We play some original music for, and when I say original, I mean music originally written for guitar and oboe. There isn't a whole lot of it. It's not a really common combination, but there's a French composer from the 18th century, Napoleon Coste, and we play some of his music. Original commissions. We've had a couple of composers write pieces for us, some of them incorporating, as I mentioned before, houseplants, and others with electronics and improvisation as elements. So it covers really the gamut from very traditional classical all the way to contemporary and avant-garde.
Now, you mentioned before that a lot of the music you play is maybe less accessible. So is the tunes you're playing for us, they're kind of stuff you fall back on or you play when you know as a break from the other stuff you perform?
Yeah, so my training is in classical guitar, and so I like to come back to that guitar repertoire, even though most of what I do now fits into the contemporary classical world, whether it's playing electric guitar or conducting or some classical guitar. Most of what I do now is more, I don't want to say avant-garde, but more influenced by those kinds of sounds. And they might be really spacious, ambient, and improvised pieces. I have a piece where my wife and I play together that involves both of us improvising sounds with a houseplant.
How does that work? How do you play a houseplant?
Well, you can use contact microphones and affix them to the plant and then manipulate the leaves and stems to send sounds through the contact microphone, or you can just put an overhead, like a condenser mic, and pick up the rustling sounds, and really any way you want to do it. You just make noise with the houseplant. There's a long tradition in 20th century music of using houseplants. John Cage wrote a piece for Cactus where you put a contact microphone on it and you pluck at the spines of the cactus, and it makes a very percussive sound.
Wow.
So, yeah, it kind of falls into that tradition.
That sounds a little bit hazardous. How do you do that and not end up spiking yourself on the spines?
I guess, being very, very careful. You might tape up your fingers, put Band-Aids over them.
Mm-hmm. Have you performed that?
I haven't played it, but I've seen it performed here in town. And it's a really cool piece. I mean, just Cage's idea, I guess, was about liberating sound and liberating our perceptions of what constitutes a music and what constitutes a musical instrument. So I think it's a very effective piece, and it's very meditative, even if it might look kind of funny. You know, a lot of what goes into Cage's music, some people just think it's a joke or think it's funny, and I think he was kind of okay with that, too. Mm-hmm. To some extent.
I guess the idea, though, of using plants as the basis for musical instruments goes back a ways, right? I mean, think about what a guitar is made of, or even think about like gourds and shakers.
Absolutely. I mean, the earliest musical instruments are like bones and rattles made of like teeth, put teeth inside of a gourd and shake it around, and you've got your early percussion instruments. And there are modern instrument makers. There's like a movement going on of people like making recorders out of carrots. And there's also an ice music festival where it's not a vegetable instrument, but using ice and carving ice into playable musical instruments.
How did you get started in guitar? When was the first time you picked up a guitar?
So my first guitar, it was a bass guitar, electric bass guitar. When I was 12 years old, I started playing in a band. I had an imaginary band with my friends from probably age 9. And then when everybody else had bought like real instruments, like there was one guy got the guitar and one got the drums, and I still wanted to be in the band, so I had to beg my mother to take me to Thoroughbred Music and buy a bass guitar so that I would have a role to play. Mm-hmm. So that was when I was 12, and I was mostly self-taught. I took some lessons and really frustrated my early teacher by being a terrible student. And then I played in punk bands and indie rock bands and played some folk music in my teenage years, and it wasn't until I got to college when I started studying classical music.
So you knew you wanted to study music when you got to college? Was that something that was revealed to you along the way?
I thought what I wanted to do was I wanted to be a spy. Wanted to go into like intelligence, basically, and I thought that was my path. I'm going to work in languages and intelligence. And then, like, after I started looking into it, while I was taking some music classes, I realized like all of my grades in like international relations and Western European politics, I'm getting C's in these classes and I'm getting A's in my music classes. So I kind of, that's how it was revealed to me that I needed to change directions.
Mm-hmm. You're also involved in the Accidental Music Festival. Tell me a little bit about what happens there.
Sure. So Accidental Music Festival is a festival for contemporary, classical, avant-garde, and experimental music. And we founded it in 2011. And we've presented a lot of world premieres by, you know, living composers. We've made the Florida premieres of a bunch of pieces that nobody's performed before in the state, and we also bring internationally touring chamber musicians to do concerts here.
So tell me about the next song you're going to play.
So the next song I'm playing is called Meditação by the Brazilian composer Garoto, a Brazilian guitarist composer from the first half and middle of the 20th century. So he was from kind of the generation before Jobim and after Villa-Lobos in terms of the famous Brazilian composers. And he was primarily a guitarist. He did a lot of radio performances, like regular radio shows with big bands, but was an extremely gifted and subtle, nuanced composer using kind of the language of Debussy and Ravel and filtering that through Brazilian popular music. Thank you.
That's guitarist Chris Belt performing a song called Garoto. Chris Belt, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
And that interview first aired in August last year. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Danielle Pryor answered the phones. Our intern is Shania Richburg. You can find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.